Session number 11899, Mr. B.J. Edwards, Reel 2.
Mr. Edwards, Reel 2.
I say they came down through the Chinese rubber into the, and surrounded the police station, a very large force of them, I think about 150. And they were well armed. I mean, they had automatic weapons, they had Tommy guns. I know they had Tommy guns. They had Stens. I'm not sure they didn't have a Bren or two. Those were the weapons of those days. They completely surrounded the police station, called on them to surrender and hand over all their weapons. The police had it was a wooden police station built on piles. The barracks were at the back, police barracks were at the back, they were made of wood, also on piles. It was close to the river, the station was down by the river, the jetty there. It had a wire fence around it. They came up to the fence, or some of them came up to the fence apparently, and called on them to surrender, and the police fired back, and they didn't surrender, they were completely surrounded. There was a terrific action there, really. The police fought extremely well, but underneath the police station they had built, because it was a bad bandit area actually, although they hadn't actually had any trouble up to that time in that particular spot, but it was always a potential area. They'd built a sandbagged enclosure below the police station. You'd get down through it through a trap door, so you've got a protection of the sandbag, you fire back from there. So what they did, the police put up a very good fight, in actual fact. They were completely overwhelmed in the end. I think there were only about three or four survivors who were all wounded. They poured fire into the station. They poured fire into the barracks. A number of the police wives and families were injured. I think some were killed. The Malay Kampong people up the road from Kampong Bukit Kepong, which is a mile or two further up from the station area, came down. They only had shotguns in those days. The auxiliary police, the Kampong police, they had some shotguns. And they came down and tried to help the Malay police in the station, but they were beaten back because they had a block across the road from the Kepongs. They couldn't get through. They were obviously ran into heavy fire. One or two of those were killed, and they couldn't break through. The police station was eventually taken over, destroyed, and I say 9 or 10 PCs, I can't remember exactly how many were killed. That was a major setback. Actually, they didn't get off scot-free because there were four or five, if I remember rightly, four or five CTs believed to have been killed. I went up there because we heard about the firing. I was in Moore, 30 miles away, and a message came down that this attack had taken place.
From a villager?
Came down from a person who had driven down the Lenga Road flat out to Moore to tell us about it. First of all, he told the OCPD at Pago, who was an old friend of mine, called John Joe Raj, an Indian, Malaysian Indian, who later rose to senior rank in the force. He was an inspector at the time. I was a cadet ASP. John Joe Raj rushed up with his jungle squad, small jungle squad from Pago, to Lenga and set off from Lenga, which is the end of the road, up to Bukit Kepong. I rushed up from Moore with my squad, and we got up there together, really. And we joined up at Lenga. He'd just gone on a little bit ahead, but we caught him up. And we got up there, and of course, by the time we got up there, the police station was... The bandits, of course, had gone. The CTs had gone. I mean, they beat it. And had gone retreated into the jungle. There were no troops up there at the time. But there was a Gurkha platoon, which was coming back from operations the other side of the river. They were contacted, and they came across and set off in pursuit of the CTs. But nothing came of that, because the CTs had had a oh, I think about a 12-hour start, and they were way out into the jungle. Some intensive operations, jungle operations, sweeps and things like that were organised. But we didn't find that particular gang. I don't think they might have found them later, but in the immediate follow-up, there was no success to that. But certainly when I got up there, the place was a complete shambles, of course. The station was burnt down. There was a lot of damage to the barrack blocks in the back. There was dead and wounded police all over the place. Of course, all the arms had gone. They'd taken everything. One of the CTs had been killed. At least not the CT, they dragged the body away, but part of his head was lying in the police station compound. So that was definitely one that was they'd got. If I remember rightly, there were four or five CTs killed, but it was a very bad reverse at the time.
And any other reverses that you remember, Muir? Month was that in, by the way?
That was, I'm trying to remember when that was. That was 1950. It was sometime in 1950. I think it was about mid-1950, that sort of time, I think.
Any other reverses or incidents you remember from the days at Muir?
Yes, I do. I remember we lost a police. In those days, we had a number of European police sergeants who were recruited mainly to help set up a special constabulary for protecting estates and protecting vital points, but they mainly were rubber estates. They later became police lieutenants. The rank was changed. But in those days, they were still called police sergeants. We had a police sergeant ambushed and killed up there. I remember that well. That was on the Lenga Road, on the estate. I can't remember the name of the estate now. But on the Lenga Road, about 20 miles up from Moore. We had a couple of ambushes on Craigie Lee Estate, which was quite a big estate, with four or five European manager and three or four assistants on it. Assistant managers. One or two of those were ambushed. And they weren't. I can't remember. There was nobody killed there, but there certainly was a police lieutenant lost up the Lenga Road. I remember that well.
What do you think could have been done in those days to have improved things with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, I don't think that anything could have been done that more than was done at the time. I mean, we were doing our best with very limited resources. We could have had more resources. I mean, I remember we had there was a lot of argument about a lack of armour for the police, because if you're moving around roads in, especially obviously in the country areas and in areas close to the jungle and through remote rubber estates, you really needed armour. There was a great lack of armour. I mentioned that when I first went out in 49, I mean the transport was mainly Chevy trucks, which were completely unarmoured. A number of those were ambushed around the country. I do know that that wasn't a safe way of going about. We wanted more armour. We eventually got more armour. We got GMC armoured vehicles, which were like a rather old-fashioned type of troop carrying armoured vehicle, like an armoured personnel carrier, really. But that didn't come till later. No, I mean, there was a lack of equipment. I mean, we were short of equipment. That was rectified later. I mean, later on we got all the equipment. It took some time for that to happen, though. And, of course, most importantly, as I mentioned earlier on, I'll flog the point, but the most important thing, of course, is to, in that type of operation, it doesn't matter, I believe, whether it's in Malaya or whether it's anti-IRA in this country and that sort of thing. I mean, you really rely on intelligence. Without intelligence, you are really operating with your hands behind your back, and any success that you have is a is pretty fluky without intelligence. I mean, it's a lot more due to luck than anything else. Without good intelligence, you must have good intelligence. We didn't have that. We built it up, and latterly, of course, we had good intelligence, and that's really how the emergency was. The back of the emergency was broken, I believe, in the long run, was in the end, was through an adequate intelligence system.
How did the Yongpeng area compare with Moore?
Oh, well, Yongpeng was a very much more a more remote area, in so much as it was a small Chinese village. There was a very little Malay population in particular in the Yongpeng area. There were very few Malay kampongs there. I'm just trying to recall. Just around Yongpeng, no, hardly any Malays at all. It was a predominantly Chinese area, rather peculiar because the Chinese there were mainly Hakkas. It was rather most of the Chinese in Malaya are Cantonese and Hokkiens and Teochews, but these were Hakkas. And also some Hokchus, another Chinese clan, if you like. Speak a different language completely. These were Hakkas and Hokchus in Yongpeng. It was an area which was really badly infiltrated by the communist terrorists. I mean, the Chinese population there again. Scattered around in outlying areas, in small holdings, in small rubber holdings, and hardly estates you'd call them, small areas of Chinese rubber. Some larger Chinese estates, quite sizable. Some Chinese engaged, of course, in vegetable planting and small-scale farming, mainly vegetable farming, out in the edges of the jungle, absolute prime targets for communists, terrorists, and absolutely under the influence of the cities completely. They're providing support. That was all, of course. I mean, during my time at Yongpeng, that was from 51, we started the resettlement. Then I think it was in 51 we started what we call the resettlement, and they were all brought in from these areas. They weren't allowed to live in those areas. They were brought into Yongpeng town and a huge, quite large resettlement area was created there, where all the outlying Chinese were brought in, and that of course made it. I mean, at a stroke, that made it very much more difficult. I mean, it didn't stop the CTs. It went on for years after that. But it made their both their communications and their supply much more difficult, and that was something. It was a fairly radical thing to do. It had to be done under those circumstances, and that actually happened, if I recall rightly, that happened in 51 when I was in Yongpeng. I mean, they built up the resettlement area at that time, but of course they still had to go out to work. And there was a very large scale operation, on a continuing basis to prevent food going out, searches and this sort of thing, and to prevent food going out and supplies of all kinds, and information going out to the CTs, because people still had to go out and work the rubber or work outside the resettlement area, which obviously was a at night, of course, they were confined in the resettlement area. But, that was an important step. And, of course, at the same time, we were getting better information by that time.
How much resistance was there from the villagers to being resettled?
Oh, quite a lot, obviously, because it was a highly unpopular thing to do, but it was a forced resettlement, make no bones about it. I mean, they were taken from their homes, their shacks, as they often were. Their possessions were loaded onto normally on a track of some kind, or if not, they were carried to a track, and their possessions, such as they were loaded onto it, and they were taken to the resettlement area and given a hut, or there were huts built there for them to live in, and that was where they had to live until the emergency was cleared up in that area.
Was there any sense in which they were better off in these resettlement areas?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, nobody obviously likes to be, and they were mere pawns. I'm talking about Chinese squatters, mere pawns in the hands of the CTs, and they were, all they wanted to do was look after their little bit of rubber and grow their vegetables and go to market with it and that sort of thing and make a bit of money and scrape a living. They obviously didn't appreciate being taken from their homes and resettled in a resettlement area, with all the extra trouble of going out to the, if they're still going to tap their rubber and that sort of thing, maybe walk 5 miles or something to do it. Obviously they were anti that. But on the other hand, of course, with that rather drastic resettlement, the government did make quite considerable considerable effort into improving the services which they could get. For instance, I mean, they set up clinics and that sort of thing, and they had the opportunity of going to school. I mean, many of these people in the outlying areas, the kids didn't go to school at all. I mean, they're just working, tapping the rubber from the age of about five or something. But they did provide, in the resettlement areas, the government was sensible enough. And it was all part of the, obviously part of the effort, the psychological effort to win the hearts and minds, as it were, of the people. And I think it, to some extent, that was... I mean, that was successful to some extent. I mean, they were brought under control. Their own security, of course, was enhanced enormously, because I mean, they were previously they were at the mercy of the CTs, and they didn't know what the CTs wanted. They were many of them were shot if they didn't provide stuff that they were asked to provide, or were thought to be giving information to the security forces for some reason or other, or somebody had said they were giving information. There were a lot of that went on, summary sort of executions by the CTs, and we had a number of instances of that.
Can you describe any instances which you personally investigated where this kind of pressure was put on?
Yes, I remember well. I can remember well going to a Chinese... This was before, must have been before the resettlement program was complete anyway. I remember going well to a Chinese kongsi. People often lived in what they call a kongsi, which is a sort of communal area. You couldn't call it a village. I mean, it might have been one or two big huts in a fairly remote location, usually in Chinese rubber and that sort of thing. If I remember rightly, there was an allegation. The CTs had alleged that information had been given from that particular kongsi to the security forces, to the police. I can't recall what it had been, but I didn't know about it. But anyway, we went out there, and of course I think they'd done two murders, including one woman who had been just strapped to a, or tied to a tree, and just bayoneted, or knifed, I couldn't say what, and was badly hacked about. She was dead as a dodo. There was another person had been killed there. I can't recall. I know there were two killed in that particular, two murdered in that particular area. In other cases, we... had got information that people had been killed and they'd been buried. CTs had buried them locally somewhere, usually in rubber, very difficult to find. So we had one or two cases there, a bit grisly actually. We have to sort of exhume people who have been buried in shallow graves. And of course, in that climate, they've been there a few days, it's not too pleasant a task. But oh yes, there was a lot of that intimidation. Because they were free of that when they got in the resettlement area. I mean, that must have been a plus for a lot of them. I mean, some of them were undoubtedly sympathetic to the CTs. They'd been indoctrinated by the CTs. But a lot of them weren't. A lot of them were just wanting to have nothing to do with it, wanting to just get on with their ordinary lives. So to that extent, there were some advantages of going into a resettlement area.
You mentioned the different sections of the Chinese community, like the Hakkas and so on. Mm-hmm. Were the guerrillas drawing more support from one section than from another?
I wouldn't say so. The Hock Chews, it's a funny thing about the Hock Chews in Malaya, they are confined to two or three areas where that clan is particularly settled. One is the Yong Peng area of Johor, and the other is really quite remote from it, up in Pira, in the City Arman area of Pira, City Arman, where there is another Hock Chew community. There weren't many of them in Malaya, and those are the two main ones, I think. They were a small clan in Malaya, a large one in China, of course. They'd always been, the Hock Chews actually had always been involved in secret society, in ordinary crime, in secret societies, in illegal activities of all drugs and illegal activities of all kinds. The Hock Chews had been very prominent in that. It was very funny, really, peculiar, really, because at that time, I was ACPD officer in charge of the police district in Yong Peng. My brother was in Malaya at the time, the Malayan police, and he was officer in charge of the police district in City Arman. So we were really in charge of the two areas where Hock Chews were very, very prominent. And there was quite a lot of liaison, because there was quite a lot of ordinary crime still going on. I mean, there was a certain amount of ordinary crime still going on, secret society stuff and all that sort of thing. And that was the liaison between City Hall and Yong Peng was quite common. So that was a rather peculiar coincidence that two brothers were commanding the police district where these people operated. But no, I don't think you could say there was the majority of Chinese in Peninsula Malaysia, it is now Malaya in those days, are Cantonese and Hokkien. Cantonese, Hokkien and Teochew are the three main Chinese races or clans there. No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I didn't get any feel or impression, or I had no knowledge that the CTs drew any support from one particular, any more from the Cantonese than from the Hokkien, for instance.
You've generalised about the Chinese and the Malays with regard to the emergency, but were the Tamils just on the sidelines?
Yes, really they were. There was some Tamil involvement in with the CTs. There were some Tamil communists, of course, and there were some Tamils who were operating with the bandits, as it were, the CT units, as it were. But I never came across them, actually, myself. But I know there were some. But it was rather insignificant. I mean, the Tamils were really... the Indian population of Malaya, which is mainly Tamil, of course, mainly Tamil, in the rural areas, they were practically entirely... rubber estate labour. I mean, they were labourers on the rubber estates. That's what they were brought over to Malaya for originally, of course. So the Tamils, Telugu and Malayalams, were also Southern Indians, but the vast majority of them were Tamils. Those that were in the rural areas and therefore had contact with CTs in the operational sort of sense were entirely state labour who could contact the CTs, or the CTs could contact them while they were working out in the estates. They, at night, of course, they came back to their lines, which were in the estates, and they were within a protected area. So, you know, the Indian involvement was, I would say, negligible, really. And the Indians, of course, I mean, in the towns, you had a fair Indian population, because a lot of the Tamils and other, mainly Southern Indians, not entirely, had set up shops and were trading. There's quite a lot of, especially Indian Muslim, Tamil Muslim traders in diverse types of trade, mainly, I would say, in clothing and cloth, and in provisions. Quite a few provision merchants, mainly Tamil Muslims doing that. And, of course, a number of Sikhs still are, of course, quite a large number of, not a large number, but a number of Malayan Sikhs. A large number of those, a majority of those, of course, have been born in Malaysia. They originally came over, of course, from India, mainly either in the police, who recruited a lot of Sikhs before the war, especially. And a lot of them stayed on in Malaya, as it was, because obviously living there was a jolly sight better than it was in India. So Sikhs and Punjabi Muslims, because police also recruited PMs before the war, they came over. And of course, some came over in the police, and others brought friends and said, you know, you come over here, you get a better living than you can in the Punjab or something, or wherever they came from in India. And a number of Bengalis. But on the whole, the vast majority of the Indians in Malaya were southern Indians, Tamils, Telugus and Malayalams, with Tamils predominating. And they weren't really concerned with the emergency, to my knowledge, to any great extent.
You said that 51, 52 was the worst time. How did morale in the police force amongst Europeans hold up at that time? Did you think that the communists could win?
No. Morale was very good at all times, in my knowledge. I mean, I never got any feeling. I mean, I was a young police officer in the field, as it were. I was paddling my own canoe, as it were. I didn't have any impression that there was any form of low morale. One was left, I must say, very much to one's own devices in running. For instance, when I was in Yongpeng, a very bad area, left entirely to my own devices, really. We operated, as I indicated already, operated in very close cooperation with a company of infantry. There was always a company of troops there to back you up. And I had very, very good dealings with the second six and, well, all the troops, really, but second six and second Gurkhas stand out from that period. The troops tended to rotate quite quickly, although we did have a company of the second for quite a long time, and they were absolutely outstanding. I never got the impression that my OSPC, officer in charge of police circle, as it was a superintendent who was in Kluang, based in Kluang. I really can't